On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Sawyer Moranville about the biblical languages and whether the Christians are required to learn them, and who has argued for such a necessity for languages, what are some potential objections to it. And then we get into some of the nuts and bolts. How can learning the languages be done in ways that become more difficult and challenging versus more efficient and realistic? Who can learn the languages? Can normal church members learn languages? Can five-year-olds? Who can learn these sorts of things? And much, much more.
As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that is dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And as we think seriously, we've tried to encourage and cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We think there's opportunities to build friendships with people all across the theological map. We can learn from them, even where we disagree significantly. They can teach us to ask questions that we didn't ask before that can help us understand our own views. And there's opportunities just to learn across the board. So a lot of what we do in these podcasts is we talk to people who have all sorts of cool ideas, who spent their lives researching or thinking or developing different ideas and different projects that are important for the health of the global church. And it's a lot of fun to learn and to explore these ideas. And today we're going to be talking with my friend, Sawyer Moranville. And Sawyer and I, we met a long time ago when I was, I think I was, maybe, I don't know if I was done with my master's or not. I know Sawyer was starting his master's at least. We were members of the same church in Louisville, Kentucky. And so this is going to be a lot of fun to talk a little bit about biblical languages, the imperative to learn them, to know them, and maybe to give some encouragement to those of you who are slaving away in a program and you feel like there's no light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, I hear that all the time, especially with Hebrew. People get into Hebrew and they feel like it's sand in their teeth and they hope it ends quickly. So Sawyer, before we jump in, tell me a little bit about yourself and then what made you so passionate about the biblical languages.
Hey Jordan, it's so great seeing you, man. I'm so happy to be here. So I would say, raised in Montana, went to seminary. Obviously, that's where we met. I think you were in your last semester of your master's and then transitioned to some work over at U of L and stuff like that. And we're thinking about your THM after that. But that was my first semester, though, that we met. And it was over at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And it's a necessity to get an MDiv. You have to take language classes. I think that's becoming less common, perhaps, in some theological institutions, but at least at Southern Seminary at the time, they required it. I'm not sure the requirements now, but I was like, oh man, this is not going to be exciting. I was never a language guy in high school. I managed in Spanish, and then I ditched it all after that, and to my disappointment, but. So when seminary came, I was like, well, I got to learn these things. And long story short, I took Greek and I was like, oh, okay, I made it through. I have to take another class, got through my second semester. And I'm like, I think I'm starting to like this a little. This is kind of fun. So let's take a Romans exegesis class with Dr. Schreiner. Took that class and I was like, wow, this is really incredible, even though it's very exhausting. And, but then, the whole other beast is Hebrew. And I was like, oh man, I need to take a couple semesters off. But I got kind of interested in Latin at the same time because of the comparative, helps of learning the grammars of those Indo-European languages. So I was like, let's just learn some Latin. And it was at that time that I actually got interested in our Latin professor, Dr. Flatt. He's a professor at Boyce College. And he is actually into spoken or communicative Latin. And so that was interesting. That kind of got me exposed to that world. And after that, I started learning Hebrew. And long story short, my wife and I went to Israel. I studied at what was once called the Institute for Biblical Languages and Translation, which is a mouthful. Now it's called the Whole Word Institute. I received a master's in classical Hebrew over there, and now I'm back in the States working for a church, teaching the youth in Pennsylvania at Greater Ford Bible Fellowship Church, and I'm actually doing a THM at Westminster Theological Seminary just to see if I want to do a PhD. If not, that's fine. But my side labors now are we just founded a nonprofit called Lingua Deo Gloria Ministries, and I am the executive director and founder of that organization. So we're really excited to see where that goes. And we exist to freely teach the biblical languages to Christians across the globe.
That is awesome. And I am a stand accountant for the THM. I think it's a fabulous degree. So if you don't know, I would tell you to go get a THM. If you're thinking about higher education, but you're not sure what to do next, that after the master's degree anyway, I think that's a better next step than is other programs. And so let's start maybe the question. So on your website, on the linguadeogloria.com, if you go to the homepage, I think it's on the homepage. Is it on the homepage? Somewhere on here, when you're talking about what, like the about of the program, you mentioned the idea that biblical languages, it's imperative to learn them, to understand the Bible. Can you explain why you think that is the case? Because I imagine there's a good amount of people, even people who have taken the languages, who would say, this is not an imperative. We're just fine with the English translations.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, every generation, actually every couple years, our language changes, right? That's why we have the NASB 2020. We have the NASB 1990-something. I don't know. We have the LSB. We have the ESV. We have the RSV. We have the NRSV. We have the New Jerusalem Standard Bible. Every single, I don't know all of the translations, but we have a plethora. And I don't know if I would necessarily say that all Christians need to learn Hebrew, but I would definitely say that all Christians, it would be advisable to learn and encouraged, strongly encouraged to learn Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic too, if possible. But I'm not an idealist. I know that not everybody will do that. I know that an overwhelming majority will not. But I do think that Bible translations change by necessity, or we need new translations all the time. But to get those translations, you need to go to the source texts, right? Because in Greek and Hebrew and other languages, there are lots of idioms that we just can't fully grasp unless we know the original languages. So often in English, you might see, the Lord is patient. But there is a phrase in Hebrew that says, Erech Apaim, which is the length of the nostrils of Yahweh. And if you just, I know it might have been cemented in the language as patience or long suffering is what we get, right? But there is a sense where whenever Yahweh's nose is long, it means he is long suffering. When his nose is on fire, it means that he is angry and furious. And this is theological language that we should really come to understand. It came from a culture that perhaps thought quite differently than us. And if you think about it, just frankly, when you think about a nose, when somebody gets angry, you know, their nose gets maybe red and it just scrunches up. And so there are important theological ideas that we just can't always see in English. But praise God for wonderful translations. And that's really what the Reformation was for, right? To bring the languages into the biblical languages into our heart language. I do think that there are a number of wonderful reasons to learn the biblical languages. And as I mentioned, though, translations, every generation needs to revamp their translation, unless you're a KJV only. but most people aren't, at least anymore. And so there is an importance of understanding every single word in the Bible. And every generation needs to study the languages again and go back to the original text. I think that there are many other reasons. I won't go into them right now, but that's just a simple, basic reason why I think it's important.
Yeah, you mentioned, it's funny you mentioned the King James Version. I have never understood the appeal to thinking the King James Version is like the only inspired version and that we cannot improve upon it. It just makes no sense to me. Now, Are there those in the history of the church who have really dedicated themselves to like arguing in favor of the biblical languages just matter like a ton? Like I remember when I was a student, I can't remember. I think it was Martin Luther. There's some quote by Martin Luther that my Greek professors would always share. Like anytime people were struggling, they're like, oh, Luther loves the languages. Here's a reason that to keep on. Do you have any stories like that?
Well, I don't know if I've ever seen anybody in the history of the church say that everyone should learn the languages, but I think it's quite common for pastors or professors to say that at least those who are teaching the Word of God should at least get a basic understanding of them, and they would strongly encourage that, right? And that's why we have things like Daily Dose of Greek, by Dr. Plummer, who encourage long-term retention of the languages. But I don't know if I can think of anybody particularly. I do know, though, let me say with less certainty. It seems to me that in the history of the church, perhaps let me just speak Reformation, post-Reformation, it seems that Reformed theologians strongly recommended by their very own practice that people should learn the biblical languages. Because if you look in their texts, their written texts, they're often just quoting whole words or phrases in Hebrew. I mean, you can look in some of the texts. I know that they wrote in Latin most of the time, and then they were translated to perhaps German or French for Calvin. But a lot of them, they just by nature studied these things. It was natural for them. It's what they did. And granted, that's for a more academic type, and perhaps we'll talk more about, as you mentioned, a blue-collar worker. Should all people study? And I would say it would be awesome if all the church could learn. And I'll just give a little foretaste of what I want to talk about in the future. I think methodology is really important for that. And so I think that the methodology can really affect all people and give great joy to learners. But so I would say that in regards, though, in my navigation of, you know, the history of the church, I don't know if anybody's ever said that all people should or all people need to, but I think it's strongly encouraged, of course, Luther, of course, Calvin, I think Melanchthon as well. All of those reformers were just really competent in their Greek and Hebrew. I mean, they were studying Greek since a young age, maybe 8, 9. And so Hebrew, they probably picked up when they were 18 to 20. So they started far earlier than most of our modern day theologians. So it seems go on.
That makes sense. That tracks. I know John Gill, I think, is one of the guys who's self-taught, you know, all these different languages. He's extremely proficient in Hebrew and Latin and all these and everything. And it's just like, how do you self-teach yourself all these things? And so I do want to get to the methodology question to hear how you think that's the best approached. I do have one question before I ask that, though, is you mentioned something along the lines of it would be good for like every pastor to at least have some sort of basic understanding of the languages. And for the longest time, I was taught in my own language classes of unless you like reach a certain level of language acquisition and skill, do not touch it because it's too dangerous and you're going to make mistakes. Do you think that's a fair advice?
Yeah, that advice I've heard it a lot as well. I wouldn't necessarily say that that is the best of advice because there's a lot of Christians who just want to know some things about Greek and Hebrew. So first off, for the sake of Christian joy, I wouldn't encourage a group of people to suppress other Christians and say, oh, if you're going to study Hebrew and Greek, you need to at least take 5 semesters. Before you can start using those in your conversations with other believers. I think there's a lot of benefit even to learning the alphabet or other things. Of course, in any generation, there's going to be people who distort or twist the knowledge that they have and say, oh, I have the knowledge of five Hebrew words, and these five Hebrew words will unlock the door to eternal happiness and joy. If you know these words, you're going to be strengthened like no other Christian. You're going to have power to live the Christian life like Christ did. You know, so of course there's people who can twist those, but I think if you have a believer with discernment, with wisdom, and who is maybe a little hesitant to make really, really, really intense theological conclusions from one word that they learned, I think it's encouraged. I mean, you might as well start somewhere. And look, if you know, Jesus spoke Hebrew and probably, you know, Greek as well, and other the apostles and others, it just seems like a fun language to learn. So I wouldn't tell people to not learn it. But I do think that there are some dangers, of course, for those who learn just a tad bit.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned another interesting thing that I hadn't really thought about, the idea that our own language is constantly changing. And that is part of the need for continued translation work, is just the fact that our own languages are updating. I mean, how much is this like, in your mind, is this the Gen Z language where they use these like weird words that I've never heard and they're assigning meaning to it? Or is it actually structurally, you would say the English language is updating every so often and it really is making a significant difference in meaning?
Yeah, I mean, we know at least from the last 50 years that that's the case, especially with our technological revolution. I mean, you have people making, this was now, I'm dating myself, obviously not, I'm only 30, but you know, 10 years ago, maybe 12, it was the selfie. And granted, this, the word selfie is never going to appear in the Bible, but there is new language that spontaneously, you know, springs into being. That happens all the time. I mean, my wife's younger brother's 18 and he's in college now, and he's saying all these words that I'm like, what are you talking about, man? This is common language though for millions and millions of millions of people. And of course, not every word is going to be carried over into a Bible translation. We'll never see the word like selfie or, this new word called Riz. I'm dumb, man. I don't even know what these high schoolers, college people are saying now. But there, you know, some of these words, I'm like, those will never appear in the Bible. But there are some words and phrases that get cemented into our culture and that sound natural to us, and that eventually, maybe in 30, 40 years, if they hold fast, they're going to be in our Bible translations. And so, our language definitely changes. Maybe it won't be a significant majority of words today that are being created that will transfer into our future Bible translations. But I do think that there is always an important, we always ought to go back to the original languages and then obviously translate in every generation to help people understand the best. So,
yeah. So you've mentioned the methodology question, and I'm interested to hear more about that. I imagine there's a good amount of people who have tried their hand at learning the languages, and it has been very difficult and challenging. Is there a better way? So maybe the idea is to sketch some bad ways and to explain to me why these make learning languages difficult, and then help me to understand what a more appropriate way to acquire languages is.
Mm, yeah. Well, I want to be very hesitant because I don't want to be a fighter, a fighter in the language world. I'm not like I'm going to die on my own hill or whatever when it comes to methodology. But I do think that as creatures gifted with the ability to speak languages, granted, I know that not all people post-Babel have the ability to speak many languages or even one, we have some mute people, which we absolutely understand. But for the most part, God has given everyone the ability to speak and to listen to languages. So let me just go from my personal experience. So I studied Hebrew and I studied Greek at least, and I was one of the few who could grit and bear pain to see the fruit in the future. But I know very few people can do that. They don't like to abuse themselves like I do, And so at least in regards to language education, I'm willing to just, you know, bang it out, you know, work really hard, spend 3 hours a day, 6 days a week, learning Greek. And that's what I did for a long time. And it was brutal, though, man. It was really tough. And granted, there's fruit at the end, but it just kind of made me question, why is this so hard? And I understand people always say that with any language. When you learn a language, it involves time. That's the first factor, right? It takes a lot of time. But I do think that methodology is important because it gets people excited or depresses certain students. And so what I want to do, though, is find, as a creature gifted by God, as we all have been, with the ability to learn languages, I think we should look for the most efficient and effective methods, right? Because we obviously know that everything can be more efficient or less efficient, right? If we have, you know, Mercedes-Benzes and Ferraris and other things because they're more effective and efficient than the cars during the day of Mr. Ford, right? We have changed. Things get faster. Things get more efficient and more effective. I view it the same way with language education. I think we should always be looking for the best possible methods, not jump into any specific party and say, oh, this is bad and this is good, but take the best from every domain, every realm, and use that and incorporate that in our language classrooms. So, and I'll just be frank. The translation flashcard approach is very ineffective. And I spent endless hours when I first began Greek and Hebrew doing flashcard translations. It's perhaps one of the worst ways to learn a language, at least to learn vocabulary, because it makes you go through multiple avenues. So you see a picture and then you see, let's say, the Hebrew, and then you have to turn it over and go into your mediator language, right? Your English or your French or your, you know, German. And then it gets to your brain and you're like, okay, that makes sense. But it's really hard for most students to remember. The brain is really good at remembering certain things, but not abstract, obscure language, you know, morphology, you know, letters and vowels and other things like that. It doesn't retain those as effectively as it does pictures, right? So it seems like from as I study and research and even learn myself and teach my students through our nonprofit, pictures students, first off, always find more joy with. It cuts out the middleman language of English or French or German or whatever other language you have. So it becomes direct, right? It's the direct approach. And that's why some people call it a direct method, because you don't have to go through a mediator language to get to what you want to learn. All you need to do is look at an image and then have the Hebrew or Greek or Aramaic term below it, if it's a picture book. Or somebody can speak it audibly, and then you can be like, wow, I know that immediately. So I show my students a horse. I pick up a horse. My little baby girl has a bunch of toy horses. So all I need to do is go to my little daughter's room and get a bunch of toys, and then I bring them into my classroom, and I say, Sus, horse, right? It's a horse, and I just show the little horse in my hand, and I use the Hebrew word, and it's become very, very effective. I mean, students are learning and retaining the knowledge, and I think it's very effective. Now, you can't do that with every word, so I understand that there's limitations to this. You know, when it comes to really abstract terminology in Hebrew, Greek, or Aramaic, you can't just put it in a picture and assume everybody will understand. So I'm not opposed to translation. And obviously, translating is important for the sake of our Bible translation. So I'm not like one of those angry, you know, curmudgeons who are like, oh, this is a new methodology and we should use it all the time in every case. And, you know, we can't ever use the methodology that's you know, being retained in our theological systems and institutions. So, but I do think that when you start using more senses that God has given us, it becomes easier to long-term retain it. So if we use our ears to hear, our hands to write, our eyes to read, and our mouths to speak, it just seems common sense to me that that would be a more effective way of learning a language than only using your eyes to see in translation, right? And so really what I'm an advocate of is not necessarily mainly just a new methodology, but it's being an advocate of using everything that God has given you to learn a language, and the languages of the Bible primarily. And I think it brings more joy that way, personally. And I've seen it in my students. I mean, my students are excited every day. You know, I just had a student email me the other day. And he's like, "I'm so happy that I can laugh in your class all the time and have a lot of fun with you." And I was like, "Wow, that's really encouraging." You know, so. But so yeah, that's kind of a tiny little introduction to this new wave of methodology that's been occurring. It's called the living language approach, or the direct method, or communicative methodology. I'm not like an angry curmudgeon, like a bitter man. Some people do, though. There's like fighting and bickering. I don't really like that. I just want to kind of bring peace and unity among the saints. But I do think that there are more efficient ways of learning languages. And the main methodology in seminaries nowadays is not this direct method, communicative methodology. It's rather the translation, as people call it, the grammar translation method. So
we could even bring in the taste element by utilizing my favorite declension strategy, Chick-fil-A, Chick-fil-A, Chick-fil-A.
I have never heard that before. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Somebody put that as their, like, on Twitter one time, and I was like, oh, that now it sticks. Now, dude, you know, I'll always remember it that way.
Genius. Yeah, so even that, though, if that helps you to learn Chick-fil-A, 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 you know, that is English, right? But still, you're learning the declensions, right? You're learning the endings of the Greek paradigm. So it's just, that's awesome, man.
So do you think part of the reason seminaries have taught traditionally in the model of language acquisition that they're using, is that just because, like, that's what they were taught and that's what the people before them were taught? And they haven't like had the opportunity to explore these other alternative methods.
A great question. It seems to me, from my observation, that is generally the case. And because obviously we teach what we're taught. If you don't learn something, you can't teach it, right? So generally, that's how it works in any realm, right? And if it's a methodology, if it's a, you know, whatever it is, a specific doctrine, we teach others what we have been taught ourselves. If it's taught from our parents, if it's taught from a professor or even a book. And that, it seems to me that that's the case with the grammar translation method, is that our professors have been taught that way, and therefore they're teaching that way because it's natural and normal. And that's how I taught some friends for a while before I jumped into a, you know, slightly altered my methodology, is I would tutor friends and, you know, I would do that with them. I would teach them. I would teach them according to what I had been taught. But then I found another group of people who taught a different way. And then I learned from them. And now I teach in that different way because of how I was taught. And I decided to choose between the two. And I was like, which one have I found to be more efficient and effective for my own study of the scriptures? And I would say it's the latter, the newer, quote unquote, newer approach. I don't necessarily think it's a newer approach, though, because Calvin and Luther spoke Latin. They communicated in Latin. They wrote in Latin. Their Latin classes were immersive. So to anybody who says that this is a new methodology and it's problematic for a number of reasons, if you have problems or if somebody has a problem with the way that Luther and Calvin and Melanchthon and other reformers learned their languages, then I understand that they could have a problem with how I learn languages now and how I teach languages. But Latin, and I could potentially contend also some Greek, but Hebrew, it seems obviously like Hebrew is kind of a different thing. I don't think that Luther and Calvin would have learned how to speak Hebrew. So I do understand in that sense. It seems like it would have been more of a grammar translation approach. But definitely Latin and sometimes Greek would have been taught as a communicative language. And that's really fascinating. And so if there are people, actually, I know many who do oppose this methodology because they don't think it helps you to critically think about a text like the grammar translation approach. There's a number of other arguments, and some of them are reasonable. I understand them, and I appreciate that critique. But I do think that our you know, heroes in the Reformed tradition, they've learned Latin and potentially Greek the same way that I'm teaching right now. So,
couldn't you just do both? Like, I don't understand what the dichotomy here is of between these two, where you're not being taught to critically engage. I'm like, can't you just learn how to do that as well, even though you're initially learning it by the method you're saying?
Absolutely, you can, and that's what I try and do. So what I say to my students is, if there's a grammatical concept that is just way too difficult that I'll never be able to explain to you in the target language, Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic, then I'm going to speak in English to you, right? So it's just that simple. Like, you know, you can use a certain methodology, but where it breaks down, use the traditional, and that's totally fine. And so that's where I still have portions of English in my classes all the time. How I do it, though, is I teach a concept only in that language. I let them listen to it, observe me saying it like 50 times. And then only afterwards do I explain what they just learned. Because that, there have been studies that when the student isn't immediately baby-fed the material, but rather has to think critically, what is my teacher saying to us in this foreign language? Their brain actually works overdrive to try and comprehend it. And then I, as a teacher, will give them 20, 30, 40 examples in context. And then they can be like, oh, I think I understand it. But I, at the end, still, for safety, I explain in English what I just taught them. So I'll say, do you understand that that's the relative clause that I just introduced? It means which or that. And so that's how I do it. So I incorporate both of them. And I'm not like I've been saying this whole time, I'm not in one party or the other. So.
And I know you have resources, I think, on your website, even for children to be learning languages. I mean, is there any one group that you feel like these people are the most capable of learning the languages easily? And is there any group that you would say it's going to be much more challenging for you to learn the languages?
That's a great question. I would say that, let me say something maybe not controversial, but something that goes against the grain. A lot of people say that adults aren't effective at learning languages. That's not true. That is, for me, that is just, I don't think that's true, because God has given us the ability to learn languages. And so that is where I think it comes down to methodology and enthusiasm. Okay. So I have known many adults who've learned to fluency multiple languages. The reason they've learned them to fluency is because they're passionate. So passion is the main driver of language learning. If you don't have passion, then you're never going to be able to learn a language, right? So that's why a lot of people, every year they have their New Year's resolutions. They say, oh, I want to start learning Spanish. And then they're all by themselves. They look at Duolingo for a couple weeks, and then it just kind of pitter-patters out. But passion is instilled in a student when you have other human beings with you to learn a language, and when you have a really wonderful methodology. And so I think that all people, granted, there might be a certain age, if you get into your 60s or 70s, it might not be as easy. I understand that. But I would say for most people, children, those in their 20s, 40s, 60s, should be able to learn languages because of the gifts that God has given them.
I like that answer. And so if you were to give a pitch, let's say if you just went to any normal church, at least here in America, and you were to have an opportunity to speak to everybody there, the pastors, deacons, normal church members, mm-hmm. when you're sort of explaining to them about the necessity of the biblical languages, what's your pitch to say you all should at least try your hand at learning a little bit of it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first, there's a number of reasons. I would say, as I mentioned earlier, you can understand the biblical mindset a little better. You can understand idiom that you can't see it in English. That, you know, famous movie and famous phrase goes lost in translation. There's a reason why that's a common popular phrase, lost in translation. It's because it's impossible to see something. Praise God, though, most things you can see in translation quite well. We know the gospel of Jesus Christ is clearly seen in translation. That's why we preach in English and we don't preach in Greek or Hebrew, praise God. We preach in English because we know through these languages, through translation, that we can know Christ Jesus in the English language. When I think about Jesus, I think in English. I think that Jesus is good. Now, I'm not saying the word agathos or, kalos like in Greek. I think when I think about Jesus Christ, I think through a language that God has given me. And so Jesus, I understand him through the text of the English Bible, also Greek and Hebrew, of course, but mainly English still. And so I think it's important, though, also to protect people against false teaching. There's a lot of false teachers out there who like to do like astrology with Hebrew numbering systems and, you know, like weird like systems where they try and deceive people into getting them to support their ministry because they have some kind of new revelation about the future, which they got from the word Bereshit. Oh, Bereshit starts with a bet. That means it has to be the number 2. And then Resh has to be the number 18 or whatever. And this, if you put 2 plus 18 plus 20 together, equals this number. And that's the day that Jesus is going to return. If we give our students a basic understanding of Hebrew or Greek, I think we can help them to stave off false teaching in the church. But also we can prepare, and I'm a huge advocate for teaching children the biblical languages. And so that's why, frankly, that's why I made these books in the first place. Tomorrow, Good Friday, we actually are officially releasing our second published book. It's a child's beginner book of biblical Greek, and it's a Greek picture book for children. Why did I do that? It's because I wanted to teach my daughter Greek and Hebrew, and I didn't see anything beautiful and attractive on the markets. Everything was really difficult, and I can't teach my daughter grammar at the age of 2. And so I was like, oh, I'll just show her pictures. And so if I teach my daughter, though, who knows what will happen in the future? But she can learn. And if we teach our children the biblical languages, who's to say that a lot of our sons won't become pastors? Who's to say that a lot of our children won't become missionaries? They would have 20 years before they go to seminary. They would have like 20 years of preparation, at least being exposed to the biblical languages. That could make their labors later in life so much easier on the mission field. I know a lot of, actually, we just had a missionary couple, wonderful couple from an undisclosed place in Asia come over here. And they don't know Hebrew, and they're trying to figure out once they need to make a written language for this people group. So first off, they need to learn a language. Then they went further into the country, and now they're learning the second language. And now they need to write a language and create a written an orthography for this group of people. And then in the future, they're going to have to learn Greek and Hebrew to be able to, you know, translate. If we, though, can start teaching and training up our children from a young age, then we can almost bypass the necessity of even having to learn Greek and Hebrew in seminary, which would be incredible. I would love to see, you know, how the Reformation was a huge thing of getting the Bible in the hands of everybody. I would love to see a 21st century Reformation where we get the original languages in the hands of every child. And I know that sounds radical and extreme, but I think it's possible. And I think there are definite benefits to where if we teach our children from the youngest age, their brains are very malleable and pliable. And I think that they may truly be a little more effective than, you know, adults at this, because adults are more analytic and more focused and more, oh, I made a mistake. But children are really good at just hearing something and spewing it back out at you. And so I think that if we teach our children, it would really benefit them long term in the future, especially if they become pastors and missionaries or just teachers in their church in any capacity. So,
yeah. I mean, I know there's a lot of guys that I know that lament sort of the educational model that used to exist and no longer does, particularly as it comes to just languages in general. And, you know, the shocking amount of skill and ability that people had in ages, or everybody had in ages past. Yeah. And that now it seems like even people can't even read the only language you speak. Like I continue to see like just reading comprehension statistics just plummeting, even just English. I just saw a video of Jack Black trying to convince people to turn on subtitles on the TV shows they watch to help people like read. Oh, and it's like, we are at a very poor ability. Like, I don't know where we're at. Like, people are literally becoming illiterate. And so it seems that the return to even just learning these things is great. So looking at the books that you all have available, I mean, I think it's fabulous, all the stuff that you've already got out there. Are there other big projects that you're trying to work on to get to be released at some point soon?
Yeah. So I'll make a quick side note. All of our stuff are freely released as PDFs on our website. So if anybody listening to this wants to have any kind of free material, we release it on our website for free. Only two of our books as of right now have been published. We want to publish those other ones in the future, but there's some corrections that I want to make to them, make them a little more attractive so that I can publish them in the future. And they will all be published at cost. So we don't get profit for this. We're a nonprofit, and we're seeking to really make things as accessible and as cheap as possible for the global church to learn. And so, but yeah, I have, we have a number of projects that we want to learn on, work on. I actually also want to make like this is just a nerd book, a biblical / Qumran Aramaic book for children. So almost like the, but there's not a big enough corpus of biblical Aramaic to do a children's picture book. But I do know that there is great benefit to learning multiple stages of Aramaic, and it'll help you to learn Hebrew more. And it's just fun learning through picture. So I kind of want to do something like that and make the trilogy, our Greek children's book, our Hebrew children's book, and then an Aramaic one as well. But on top of that, I would say that right as of right now, my life's work is kind of devoted to a book that I'm writing. This book is modeled after a book called Familia Romana by Hans Orberg, Lingua Latina per se illustrata. If you ever look him up or find out about Hans Orberg, the author who is now no longer alive, he wrote an incredible book in the direct method, they call it. It's only in Latin. So what I'm trying to do is write a book in this similar vein, to where it's only in Hebrew and it's filled with side margin notes and pictures and maps and numbers, so that it's all in Hebrew, so that it can really be an immersive environment. But it's not going to start at level like 50. It's going to literally start at level 1. So the first page has a map with the ancient Near East. And you have Babylon, you have Babel, you have Assyria, you have Ashur, you have Yisrael, right? You have all of these places on the map. And then in the text, it's supposed to be like a graded reader, but starting very, very, very basic. So I will say, Jerusalem is in Israel. And then I'll say Nineveh or Nineveh is in Assyria. And then I will say, where is the Jordan River? The Jordan River is in Israel or something like that. Where is the Nile? The Nile is in Egypt. So it's very basic, and you see pictures, and it's a long-term project. I've been working on it on and off for about a year now. And it's going to take many years of my life to be able to accomplish and perfect, Because what I'm trying to do is make sure that it's comprehensible and not, I don't jump from like level, the first step on a staircase to like the fifth step. I really want to make sure people can go step by step by step in the language and not feel stressed out. And I think right now we have a lot of Hebrew materials that are great for more advanced students, but very, very few that are really wonderful for the absolute beginner. And so I really want to get a text that is so easy that somebody could look at a couple pictures, be in a class with me for 15 minutes or something, and start, going through the text and learning the language. And so that's probably the main project that I'm working on, but we have many others that we're thinking about in the future. So
that's awesome. Well, this has been a ton of fun. And so what I need you all to do, if you haven't already, I've put a link in the show notes so that you can go directly to the website and check out all the resources that Sawyer has. And you can go download those PDFs and use them in your own families, in your own local churches. And if you find the work and the mission valuable, you should go donate to the project to help support Sawyer and the team to continue to create more resources that are helpful for us to know the Bible and to know God ultimately through that. So Sawyer, the work you're doing here is tremendous. We thank you for the time to think through it. And you need to go check out the website. So if nothing else, go click on the link. Please go read about what they're doing. I think it's really awesome. And if you haven't been able to catch that from the interview yet, then I don't know what to tell you. I've got to like reach my hand through the phone and like give you a nudge or something to tell you that this matters and is important, and you should support it as you're able to. Maybe that's your local church thinking about ways to support ministries like these. These are the sort of things that are really, really important for long-term health of our churches and our people. So Sawyer, thanks for doing this. This is a lot of fun. And everybody who's been listening, we thank you for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.